first with wetlands and then with forests. 3 billion years of evolution have produced only one life form that can reverse this process and make our planet significantly less green. Urbanization is decolonizing the surfaces that plants painstakingly colonized 400 million years ago, turning them back into hard and barren lands. The amount of urban area in the United States is expected to double during the next 40 years, displacing a total area of protected forest the size of Pennsylvania. Within the developing world, urbanization is happening even faster and involves much more space and many more people. On the continent of Africa, a Pennsylvania-sized area of forest is converted to city every 5 years. Baltimore is the most tree-impoverished city on the east coast of the United States, where the relatively wet climate used to support dense forests. Baltimore proper contains about one tree for every 5 of the city's inhabitants. Viewed from space, only about 30% of Baltimore City appears at all green, and the rest is uninterrupted asphalt. On the same day that Bill and I arrived in Baltimore, I got a mortgage with no down payment and bought an old row house near the university. Bill moved into the attic and quickly became reaccustomed to not sleeping in a public building. It was bittersweet to have left Georgia, a place where we had both grown up so much. But like the very first plants, we needed a new place to spread out. And so we decided that this bare slab of rock could serve as home. Chapter 2. "Do you really think this is illegal?" I asked Bill over the CB radio.
"Jesus, I don't know.
Let's mull it over using the public airwaves." Bill's voice was crystal clear, which was unsurprising given the fact that he was driving the vehicle directly in front of me. We were returning to our still new home in Baltimore after a quick trip to Cincinnati, and one of us was driving a U-Haul van. "Well, I'm just thinking," I mused. "We've got at least 400 miles to go, and if a cop pulls us over and notices that we're hauling hundreds of dollars of lab equipment stamped property of the University of Cincinnati, our Maryland state driver's licenses may not qualify as sufficient proof of ownership." "Don't you have a copy of Ed's last will and testament stating, 'Being of retired mind and body, I hereby bequeath all my laboratory possessions, contaminated and otherwise, to my academic granddaughter, that she may go forth and multiply my own findings manyfold.'" Bill was actually perfectly happy to converse, and I had been put under strict orders to keep babbling after the radio in his vehicle had proved inoperable. "No, I don't have one, and I don't think that he'd want to put anything in writing anyway," I said, considering. "Maybe I'm just being paranoid," I added. "I mean, what possible crime could a cop think we were planning to commit with a bunch of beakers?"
"I don't know, you dumbass. How about inaugurating the 10,000th methamphetamine lab in West Virginia, for starters?"
Bill impressed me with his worldliness.
I didn't think that he was being very supportive, seeing as he had been at least as keen to take the stuff as I had.
Hadn't he packed and repacked the U-Haul 3 times over, successfully cramming in more boxes during each reconfiguration?
"Listen, you're right. We need to keep our eyes on the prize here, and remember that all this useless crap was free," he said, morally clarifying the situation.
The next day, we'd continue our work converting a huge basement room within the Johns Hopkins Geology Department into a magnificent laboratory, a project that we started after we moved during the summer of 1999. In between major construction tasks, we had been making the rounds at all the national scholarly conferences on biology, ecology, geology, whatever. I was getting my name out there and generally promoting the new lab. While wandering through the vendors' hall at the Geological Society of America conference in Denver during the fall of 1999, we had bumped into my favorite academic uncle,
Ed, while he was busy searching for his wife's birthday gift. I hadn't seen him in some time. He was a little grayer, but still cut the same fatherly figure with which I associated him. When I approached him to say hello, he had stopped what he was doing and greeted me with a big hug. Ed had gone to graduate school with my dissertation advisor, hence the uncle designation, and had been one of the scientists who figured out the ups and downs of sea level over the eons. He and his team had analyzed thousands upon thousands of tiny ocean shells left by the microscopic animals that lived and died at the surface of the ocean. This work had started during the 60s and led to a method by which the chemistry of a shell could be used to calculate how much ice was sitting at the North Pole, based on a series of serendipitous, indirect relationships. When Arctic summers are cold, the snow that falls during the winter does not melt, but instead builds up and packs down on itself until huge tongues of ice are forced out from the bottom of the pile. We find the tracks of such splaying ice as far south as Illinois, leading us to argue over whether unremittingly cold summers could create a snowball Earth, covered in ice from pole to pole. Because precipitation starts as evaporation, an Earth with huge expanses of polar ice is also an Earth with less ocean water, enough to lower sea level by many feet. With the sea thus drawn down, new land is exposed, and a new type of real estate opens up for plants, animals, and people. Bodies of water that have kept animals separate for thousands of years dry up, and everything begins to mix. An icy world is a brave new world, full of land to conquer and balances of power to be challenged. Ed and his contemporaries dared to believe that this cooling and warming occurred in cycles, but mourned the fact that each generation of ice would have rubbed out the tracks of the one before it, forcing them to search for new ways to read history back beyond the most recent endless winter. At the bottom of our swelling and retracting ocean, the empty shells of tiny organisms that lived their brief lives at its surface collect, and the drills that search for petroleum haul up layers and layers of the rock into which these shells have solidified. Each little shell bathed in the ocean of the time when it lived, in the water that was left over after ice had been taken out. During this bathing, the chemistry of the ocean was imprinted upon the chemistry of the shell, leading to the theory that analyses of fossil shells through time tell the history of global ice, of the glacial cycles. For decades, Ed had worked on his little piece of the theory, which progressed from being an unlikely fancy to a reified fact, and is now found within every introductory geology textbook. To do his work, Ed ran a large laboratory full of state-of-the-art equipment, that state being 1970. Ed asked me what I was up to these days, and I told him that I was building a new lab at Johns Hopkins University. I introduced him to Bill, whom he didn't quite remember from Berkeley. I knew that since I'd last seen Ed, he had been promoted to dean, and I asked him how he liked it. "I don't," he told me while picking through a tray of gemstones. "I'm retiring at the end of this year." Although he was easily in his 70s, I was nevertheless shocked by this announcement, as I was far from ready to think about losing the generation that had mentored me. I wondered what the old boys' club would make of me once my few allies, such as Ed, were no longer around to defend me behind closed doors. "What's going to happen to your lab?" I asked Ed in disbelief. "It will house a computer cluster for the new geophysicist that they just hired," he told me sadly. "All my stuff will go straight into the dumpster." "Why, do you want any of it?" The blood rushed to my head. I looked at Bill, whose mouth was hanging slightly open. The next week, we got in my car and drove to Ohio. When we got to Cincinnati, we rented a U-Haul for the one-way trip back. When we met Ed in front of the building that housed his laboratory, it was mid-morning on a Tuesday. He took us inside and introduced us all around, proudly telling people that he'd known me since I was a new student, that I was now a professor doing great things, and that I had come to town because his equipment was of too much scientific value to be discarded. He told them the stories that I had heard him repeat every time he saw me, and that he probably repeated when I wasn't around, too. He told about how I had written him a long letter after reading one of his papers, asking for the backstory of the experiments, for the details, and for the blooper reel. He told about how he had gone on a soils trip with me, and I had slept in my car because I didn't want to lose valuable daylight hours setting up a tent. He told them that I was the hardest working student he'd ever seen, and that he knew I was special from the first time that he met me. I kept my head down so that no one could see my embarrassed smile, and experimented with standing on one foot while waiting for him to finish. After he finished, I looked up at Ed and said, "Thank you." Then I cringed as one by one, the people to whom I was being introduced sized me up and down, each of them wearing a look with which I was very familiar. It was the look that says, "Her? That can't be right. There's a mistake here somewhere." Public and private organizations all over the world have studied the mechanics of sexism within science and have concluded that they are complex and multifactorial. In my own small experience, sexism has been something very simple. The cumulative weight of constantly being told that you can't possibly be what you are. And you don't do yourself any damn favors by going around in pigtails and stained t-shirts, Bill reminds me whenever I affect an air of persecution, and I must concede his point. Ed took us down into the basement and unlocked his lab for us. It was clear that no experiments had been done inside that room for years, but nonetheless it constituted about 1,000 square feet full of dusty instruments, as well as a sizable hoard of supplies. Bill was standing in one corner, and the look on his face told me that he was mentally comparing the volume of the room with the volume of the truck. I knew that his first instinct would be to simply transfer all objects from one to the other, and that I would have to make a stringent case for leaving anything behind, up to and including a drawer full of used earplugs. "Well, you'd better let us know what you would miss if we took it." My mind was bucking with greed, making it difficult for me to sound diplomatic. Ed smiled. "You know, I couldn't even tell you what most of this stuff is anymore. The guy who worked for me, brilliant guy. His name was Henrik. Too bad you never met him. He custom-made most of the instruments. We worked together for 30 years. He retired 3 years ago and lives in Chicago now, but you could contact him if you need help figuring something out. Even the factory-bought stuff he had to adapt quite a bit. He only had one arm." A long silence followed, which was broken only when Bill raised both hands to the ceiling and bellowed out, "Dear God, do you mean he was a gimp? If there is one thing I cannot tolerate, it is the idea of a freak in the lab. Disgusting." During the strange minutes that followed, Ed turned to look at me as if to say, "Where on earth did you get that guy?" I just stood there paralyzed with a serene smile on my face, as I usually did on such occasions. Ed shook his head and checked his watch, saying, "I should get back to the dean's office. The guys in facilities might help you with anything heavy if you ask. Come by my office when you are loaded up. The secretary upstairs will tell you where to find it." He pulled a necktie out of his briefcase, donned his suit jacket, and walked out. I grinned at Bill as we locked eyes. "I can't take you anywhere," I sighed. Bill is missing part of his right hand, which is also his dominant hand. For some reason, it takes people years of working in close quarters with him to notice it, if they do at all. Because his skin is extensively scarred, it is clear that his hand started out whole, and that a hunk got chopped off at some point. He must have been a very young child at the time, because Bill has no memory of the event. I think the only people who truly know what happened are Bill's parents, and they aren't at all interested in talking about it. Bill's mother has Swedish blood, and so all this lack of information makes perfect sense to me. Bill can do more with 1.7 hands than the vast majority of people in the world can do with 2. And so the only time that the non-standard nature of his appendage matters is when it provides the odd comic moment. I experience twisted glee when I insinuate to people that Bill received the injury during a bungled lab experiment. And one of Bill's favorite pastimes involves walking up behind a student who is working with a sharp scalpel and barking out,
"Watch your digits!"
We carried in the cardboard boxes and rolls of bubble wrap that we had brought with us, and moved furniture in order to set up a staging area where we could pack the items we wanted to take. We decided that Bill would disassemble the big stuff, and I would sort the little stuff, wrap everything, and pack it in cardboard. We worked for hours, focusing first on items that would be of obvious use. Unopened boxes of gloves, custom-sized flasks, independent transformers, pumps, and power supplies. We then moved to seldom used but expensive items, such as containers that could slow down the boiling of super-cold fluids when they were exposed to air. For each item that I packed, I imagined the several $100 that we'd never need to spend, and I kept a running tab. Bill carefully drew the larger items in his notebook and photographed them from all angles before taking them apart, knowing that he'd have no other assembly manual once we returned home. He also multitasked impressively by criticizing everything I did while he worked. "What the hell? You're using up all the bubble wrap. Slow down," Bill ordered me. "Oh, sorry," I answered. "Stupid me. I thought I remembered something from my PhD about how glass can break. I guess you learn better at community college." "Use less wrap, it'll go further and pack tighter, and we can take more stuff," he snarled in return. "I'll drive slow." "Why are you in such a foul mood?" I asked him. "You should be glad I set up this little heist." "Oh, I don't know," he answered. "Maybe because I drove all through the fucking night while you slept." "Did I forget to thank you for that?" I chirped with wide eyes. "Oh, well, too late now. What's done is done." We were avoiding what we wrongly assumed would be a tense confrontation over the homemade mass spectrometer on the other side of the room. We both wanted it, but we knew we couldn't take it. Eventually, we drew near it and walked around it to look at it from all angles, as if we were slowly circling wily prey. It was a big, standalone thing, about as big as a small car, fronted by a panel of analog readouts, each with a needle that had long since ceased to dance. "That thing is half glass, half metal, and half particle board," joked Bill as our eyes tried to identify the path from the inlet to the detector through the wires, gauges, and handwritten signs that said things like, "Do not over-tighten me," on the exterior of the machine. I often compare my mass spectrometer to a bathroom scale. Both instruments can be used to measure the mass of an object and report the result according to its place upon a spectrum. On your bathroom scale, the extremes of this spectrum might range from 25 pounds to 250 pounds. When a person steps on your bathroom scale, a spring is mechanically compressed, and the force is transferred to a dial that turns underneath a needle. Numbers have been painted on the dial to increase with increasing force. A bathroom scale can very accurately tell you whether the object on it weighs about 50 pounds or is really closer to 200 pounds. Your bathroom scale is great for allowing you to determine the difference between an adult and a child. But it's just not accurate enough to help you figure out the amount of postage needed for your Christmas letter. For that problem, you should use the scale at the post office, which is perhaps a tipping bar that balances perfectly when you slide a weight to the marked position, where it exactly offsets the weight of the letter set on the tray. The bathroom and post office scales are two machines, each one cleverly designed to yield the same type of measurement, the same end through different means. We can keep focusing in on that spectrum. Let's say we want to weigh two sets of atoms, and we'd like to be able to see which set is heavier due to its random incorporation of a handful of extra neutrons. We need to build a machine. The good news is that we only need to build this machine once, since there's no chance that anybody besides us will ever want this thing in their bathroom or government office. This frees us to make it as ugly, silly, unwieldy, and inefficient as we want to. We just need to improvise something that works for us. This is how scientific research instruments are built. The creative process born from these necessities gives rise to delightfully quirky creations, unique as their creators. Like all art, they are a product of their period and an attempt to address the issues of their age. Also like art, they appear outmoded and antiquated when viewed from within the future that they helped create. Yet there is a singular fascination to be indulged when we stop and stare at the piecework of previous scientists' hands, amazed over the care taken with the peripheral elements, just as we are dazzled by the 100 tiny brushstrokes that magically agglomerate into one small boat on the horizon within a pointillistic painting. 50 years ago, scientists such as Ed sculpted their works around huge magnets, which served as the pulsating heart of the eventual machine. The electromagnetic field generated by any magnet acts in proportion to its mass. Thus a big magnet creates a field strong enough to pull noticeably differently on different atoms. Their idea then became to accelerate two sets of atoms past the same magnet, and then measure how much each was thrown off course as it flew through the electromagnetic field, and from the flight paths determine which one contained a greater proportion of neutrons. Simple calculations showed how this should work, as the mass-dependent effects of a magnet have been known for hundreds of years. The practical problem of accelerating the particles and measuring the deflection, of actually doing it, was worked out by a fairly limited group of researchers working at the University of Chicago, whose students went on to improve the methods at the California Institute of Technology. Their techniques eventually spread to places like Cincinnati, and many years later have been automated into the easy-to-drive versions that we use in my laboratory. Back in those early days, as now, the sample was introduced for measurement as a gas and then ionized before acceleration. Magnetic deflection of the particle beam spewed the sample against a target, and each hit produced a tiny electrical signal. A row of detectors collected these electrical impulses and positioned them on a spectrum whose peaks corresponded to mass. Like a bathroom scale, these mass spectrometers had to be calibrated against familiar items with standard weight. But then they could be used for almost anything that could be coaxed into a gaseous state, including the shells at the bottom of the ocean. The instrument we were looking at, Ed's old mass spectrometer, resembled a high-tech scrap metal heap and probably weighed at least a ton. Before it was loaded with sample, its metal foyer had to be mechanically pumped free of atmosphere, as did the flight tube, In Ed's day, the pumps were little more than a motorcycle engine housed in a steel box, turning rapidly enough to create a strong suction that could be sustained as long as power could be delivered and the noise could be tolerated. The gas moved through the inlet similar to the way that a barge moves through the locks of a dam, sitting somewhere until the next chamber was sufficiently pumped free of atmosphere. To seal the gas into these waiting chambers, liquid mercury flowed in, provided a wall, and then drained out when the wall was no longer needed. The metallic fluid was almost perfect, chemically unreactive, incompressible, and electrically conductive. There was the small matter, however, of it also being monstrously toxic. Bill and I stared at the beautiful old instrument, knowing that we had no use for it, and shaking our heads at its glass saddlebags filled with liters and liters of shiny mercury. A single drop of mercury from inside an old-school thermometer requires full-on hazardous materials disposal if broken open. The mere sight of gallon jugs of mercury filled us with awe, and our minds bent over the risks that must have been taken while Ed, or rather the brilliant Henrik, observed Bill, worked with these substances for decades. A blood pressure cuff had been modified and added as a means by which to coax the mercury forward and backward, and could presumably be operated with only one hand. The paint on certain knobs was worn from years of careful turning, and the soldering evidenced repeated amateur attempts that finally resulted in two strong seams. The machine itself provided unsolicited paternal advice to the user, such as, "Is H2 off?" and "Turn this one last," written on the valves in red and black permanent marker. A bow of red yarn was tied in one odd corner, maybe to reinforce the memory of a forgettable but necessary step, or perhaps simply as a good luck charm. After we had stared at the machine from every angle, I observed, "It's a shame to throw this out. Someone should put it in a museum somewhere." "No one will," said Bill. While we were walking away, I noticed something propped up behind the instrument. It was a 1 foot square piece of wood, with the sharp ends of 10 or so screws sticking out of it. Their pointy tips were arranged in a grid, and under each one of them was written the diameter of the screw. 1/16, 3/8, 5/8, 9/16, and so forth. It served a supremely useful purpose, allowing one to quickly assess the size of a stray nut, washer, or bolt, thus helping to diagnose what the hardware had fallen off of, or for what it could be used. "No wonder Ed is in the National Academy," I said. "We have to take that." "No," said Bill. "It stays here." I was surprised by his adamancy.
"Are you nuts? It's small and we don't even need to wrap it," I pleaded.
Bill was looking at it thoughtfully. "No, it's theirs. It needs to stay with Ed."
"But it's pure genius," I argued. "It has the power to transform Western civilization, and you know it."
"Relax. I'll make you one," said Bill. "I promise." When we were finished loading the truck, we went to find Ed's office, and I knocked on his door. When he opened it, I handed him 4 sheets of paper and said, "I made a list of what we took, just so you have it." Ed followed us outside, looked into the truck, and helped us secure everything a second time. And then it was time to go. "Thank you for everything. It means a lot," I said, wanting to add something significant but not knowing what more to say. "You've probably even bought me a couple more years before they fire me," I added with a smile.
Oh, I have a feeling you are going to be fine. Ed laughed as he shook his head. Make sure not to wear yourself out along the way, okay?
His oblique recognition of my years of effort amplified the poignancy of the situation, and suddenly a big lump gathered in my throat. There in the parking lot, we two scientists conducted a homely ceremony that transferred the tools of his life, his career, to mine.
Ed's suggestion that the Earth's ocean chemistry could be reset completely was a dangerous idea when he was young, and he had stayed up nights to study while the people he knew were watching Joe DiMaggio and arguing about the McCarthy trials. 40 years later, his idea was one that I could take for granted as I dared my way into my own ambiguous future. It was kind of tragic, I reflected, that we all spent our lives working, but never really got good at our work, or even finished it. The purpose instead was for me to stand on the rock that he had thrown into the rushing river, bend and claw another rock from the bottom, and then cast it down a bit further, and hope it would be a useful next step for some person with whom Providence might allow me to cross paths. Until then, I would keep our beakers, thermometers, and electrodes in my care, hoping against hope that not all of it would be garbage upon my own retirement. While absorbed in these thoughts, I looked at Ed and was suddenly overcome by an irrational fear that he might die before I saw him again, and I hugged him hard. I couldn't bring myself to watch as Ed shook Bill's right hand goodbye. But I did notice that their handshake had morphed into a bear hug by the time that I had gotten myself into my car and settled behind the wheel. We got lost while trying to get out of the city, and then once we were finally on the interstate, Bill's voice came over the CB saying, "Shit, this thing will need gas within a couple of hours. I should have filled up while you were back there playing Goldilocks." I chastised him. "Shut up, dwarf. You just be grateful that your job is such a goddamn fairy tale. Not everyone can get away with biting the snow-white hand that feeds them the way that you do." "Yeah, well, these trucks don't load themselves, so you just remember who your real friends are," he responded. I smiled, noticing the slogan on the Pennsylvania license plate of the U-Haul that Bill was driving. "America starts here," but did not answer. I slipped a disc into the car stereo. Songs from Dawson's Creek. I held the talk button down on the CB's microphone and wrapped electrical tape around it to keep it engaged. Then I set it down carefully, directly in front of one of my car's audio speakers, secure in the expectation that Bill would be driven totally batshit crazy by the third track of those bubblegum pop songs. We got in the slow lane and drove eastward, unsure of who was following whom. Chapter 3. For trees that live in the snow, winter is a journey. Plants do not travel through space as we do. As a rule, they do not move from place to place. Instead, they travel through time, enduring one event after the other, and in this sense, winter is a particularly long trip. Trees follow the standard advice given for any extended travel within a rustic setting. Pack carefully. Remaining stationary and naked outside in the below-freezing weather for 3 months is a death sentence for almost every living thing on Earth, except for the many species of trees that have been doing it for 100 million years or more. Spruce, pine, birch, and the other species that blanket Alaska, Canada, Scandinavia, and Russia endure up to 6 months of frozen weather each year. It may not surprise you to learn that the whole trick of survival is not freezing to death. Living organisms are made mostly of water, and trees are no exception. Every cell within a tree is basically just a box of water, and water freezes at exactly 0 degrees Celsius. Water also expands as it freezes, the exact opposite of what most liquids do. And this expansion can burst whatever the water is contained within. You see this if the back of your refrigerator is a bit too cold. After a slight frost, your celery is reduced to a limp, watery mess. This is because the cell walls have burst as the cell water froze, and this has ruined your vegetable. Animal cells can tolerate frozen temperatures for short periods of time because they are constantly burning sugar to produce energy in the form of heat. Plants, in contrast, make sugar, taking in energy in the form of light. If the sun is not strong enough to keep the air above freezing, then the tree is not kept above freezing either. The Earth's rotation is such that the North Pole tilts away from the sun for part of each year, reducing the amount of heat that is supplied to the high latitudes. And this is what causes winter in the Northern Hemisphere. In order to prepare for their long winter journey, trees undergo a process known as hardening. First, the permeability of the cell walls increases drastically, allowing pure water to flow out while concentrating the sugars, proteins, and acids left behind. These chemicals act as a potent antifreeze, such that the cell can now dip well below freezing, and the fluid inside of it will still persist in a syrupy liquid form. The spaces between the cells are now filled with an ultra-pure distillate of cell water, so pure that there are no stray atoms upon which an ice crystal could nucleate and grow. Ice is a three-dimensional crystal of molecules, and freezing requires a nucleation spot, some chemical aberration upon which the pattern may start to build. Pure water devoid of any such site may be supercooled to 40 degrees below zero and still remain an ice-free liquid. It is in this hardened state, with some cells packed full of chemicals and others suctioned off for purity, that a tree embarks on its winter journey. Standing unmoved through the frost, sleet, and blizzards of the season. These trees do not grow during winter. They merely stand and ride planet Earth to the other side of the sun, where the North Pole will finally be tilted toward the heat source, and the tree will experience summer. The vast majority of northern trees prepare well for their wintertime journey, and death due to frost damage is extremely rare. A chilly autumn brings on the same hardening as a balmy one, because the trees do not take their cue from the changing temperature. It is the gradual shortening of the days, sensed as a steady decrease in light during each 24-hour cycle, that triggers hardening. Unlike the overall character of winter, which may be mild one year and punishing the next, the pattern of how light changes through the autumn is exactly the same every year. Multiple light experiments have shown that the changing photoperiod is what triggers the tree to harden. It can be triggered in July if we fool the tree using artificial light. Hardening has worked for eons because a tree can trust the sun to tell it when winter is coming, even during years when the weather is capricious. These plants know that when your world is changing rapidly, it is important to have identified the one thing that you can always count upon. Chapter 4. I was covered in dried, flattened leaves. My hair was full of them, and I could feel crunchy bits of stem on my scalp, slipping down into my collar. There were shreds of leaves stuffed into my boots, and they found their way to the insides of my socks. My wrists were stained black with the grime of the dry leaf dust that rubbed itself in whenever I pulled my gloves off or on. Sneezing yielded a smear of mucus with leaf mulch in it, and I could taste the grit of dry, dead leaves in my mouth. Every time I reached up with my knife, a gush of compressed dried leaves rained down on me. I didn't even bother trying to keep the debris out of my eyes. I just shut them tightly while I dug. Bill and I were spending the summer about 700 miles north of the northern coast of Alaska, on Axel Heiberg Island, which is part of the vast Nunavut territory of Canada. Thanks to our GPS, we knew exactly where we were on the globe, within inches, actually. And yet our overwhelming feeling was that we were completely off the map. Our group of 12 scientists represented the only human beings within a 300-mile radius. The Canadian military flew in every few weeks to check up on us, but in between their visits, we were completely alone with our thoughts and with one another. One of the strangest things about being thousands of miles from anywhere is how incredibly safe you feel. Nothing surprising is going to happen. You aren't going to bump into anyone you don't know. Water bleeds from the melting permafrost, making the earth spongy and so soft that you can't even fall down and hurt yourself. In theory, hungry polar bears could wander inland and eat you, but the scientists I know who have been working there for more than a decade tell me that they have yet to see one that far inland. The landscape is flat, and you can see for 10 miles or more because the air is crystal clear. There's no grass, no bushes, and certainly no trees. You don't see many animals either, because there's almost nothing for them to eat. The life forms that you do come across, a lichen glued to a rock, a single musk ox trudging across the landscape, a nondescript bird passing far overhead, are few and far between. The sun never ever goes down. It just endlessly circles you, low in the sky, as if it were riding a merry-go-round with you standing at the center. Life is quiet and surreal. You abandon your habit of keeping track of what day and what time it is. You sleep until you wake up. You eat until you're full, and you work until you're tired, trading back and forth among these three activities. No matter how long you work in the Arctic during the summer, you are there for exactly one day. Then you go home in order to avoid winter, a 3-month night during which the sun never rises. You won't be there, but that lichen, that bird, and that muskox will be, stumbling around in the dark and still searching for something to eat. The place where we work in the Arctic is more than 1,000 miles away from the nearest tree, but it wasn't always like that. Canada and Siberia are loaded with the remains of what were lush deciduous conifer forests that sprawled north of the Arctic Circle for tens of millions of years, starting about 50 million years ago. Tree-dwelling rodents climbed the branches of these forests and looked down upon huge tortoises and alligator-like reptiles. All of these animals are now extinct, but together they formed an ecosystem more reminiscent of Alice's Wonderland than of anything that can be found today. It's obvious that the climate of the polar regions was warmer during that time, and that there were certainly no frozen fields of unforgiving ice like there are today. What puzzles us as botanists, however, is that those forests somehow persisted through 3 months of total darkness each winter, to be followed by 3 months of continuous summer sun. Extreme light regimes are incredibly stressful to today's plants, which generally would not live through a year of such treatment. In contrast, 45 million years ago, the Arctic was home to thousands of miles of dense, productive, deciduous forests that thrived through these wild swings in illumination. The discovery of trees that could live in the dark is akin to a discovery of humans that could live underwater. We must conclude that either the trees of the past were capable of something that today's trees cannot do, or the trees of today no longer use these talents, and instead keep them tucked away as an adaptive ace up their evolutionary sleeve. Bill and I, and 10 other researchers who hailed from the paleontology department of the University of Pennsylvania, had been set down on Axel Heiberg in groups of 4, delivered by helicopter, after riding a twin-engine aircraft, after riding plane after plane, moving north from Toronto to Yellowknife to Resolute, and on up for days. Standing in the mud, watching the helicopter fly off, we looked down at our backpacks and up at each other, and realized how profoundly alone we were in our little group. Over the next 5 weeks, the paleontologists would spend day after day parked in one spot, carefully exhuming single specimens of the buried fossil trees. They worked painstakingly, basically digging a trench with 10 toothbrushes. They uncovered amazing fossils, tree trunks 6 feet in diameter and almost perfectly intact. Because the ground was frozen, the sediment covering the fossils had to be scraped off centimeter by centimeter once the sun had thawed the top layer. It was like digging through ice cream that had frozen too hard for easy serving. The paleontologists had a few different specimens that they were unearthing, and they used small cards of plastic to do it, similar to the way that you might scrape ice off of a windshield using your driver's license. They rotated among fossils, the perpetual sun slowly assisting them. The fossils were still made of wood, which is what made them precious. Most of the tree fossils you can think of have been petrified as fluids have passed through them for ages, swapping molecule for mineral until the tree has fully turned to rock. In contrast, the fossils of Axel Heiberg Island contained wood tissue that was still intact. You could even burn the fossils to heat your bath water, which is what the rough-and-ready grizzly male geologists had done with it during the 80s, when the site was first surveyed, if legends are to be believed. The paleontologists of our trip were a more housebroken version of the classic mountain man geologist, but still hard-working, hard-drinking, and fascinated with the gun that the Canadian government required us to carry in case of polar bears. I had learned to keep my distance from these types of colleagues, knowing that they would never accept me as having a legitimate intellectual claim to the site, even if our funding agency did. In their eyes, I was just a grubby little girl who couldn't lift 40 pounds with a weirdo in tow, and I embraced this role, hoping it would result in their underestimating me to the point of leaving me alone. Somehow, all of our sleep cycles settled into a pattern where Bill and I worked while they slept, and vice versa. Bill and I also took a fundamentally different approach to the site as compared with our more established colleagues. I was obsessed not with the fantastic individual fossils, but with the incredible duration and stability of the forest as a whole. This was no flash-in-the-pan freaky ecosystem. This configuration of global biology had persisted for many millions of years. Millions of years during which huge amounts of carbon and water flooded into the Arctic and were transformed into leaves and woods and then shed annually in a gush of tissue. How in the world did the system sustain itself? There is nowhere near that kind of fresh, liquid water available in the Arctic now, not to mention the lack of soil nutrients. Bill and I decided that instead of looking at a single snapshot of time by digging up a few individual trunks, We were going to tunnel vertically through the whole mess, looking for subtle changes through time in the chemistry of the mummified wood, leaves, and sticks. This meant digging apart and sampling layer after layer of the dead, compressed debris that had accumulated over millions of years. As we burrowed vertically through cross-sections of dry, rotted leaves, we sampled centimeter by centimeter and recorded precisely where in the column we were. By the end of 3 summer field seasons, we'd sampled our way through 100 vertical feet of time and were able to identify at least one strong swing in climate that the forests had been able to tolerate. From this, we have argued that these ancient Arctic ecosystems are better characterized as resilient than stable. We chose a spot across the basin, far from the place where the paleontologists were excavating, and for weeks on end, Bill and I dug up through sediment layers that were more than 10 feet thick and interbedded with gravel and silt. Each week we'd thrash around in a different 12-foot pile of 40-million-year-old dry compost. Often we worked while hanging off of one side of a gentle, sloping, and soft cliff that was continuously giving way out from under us, sending us tumbling down the hill covered in a debris slide. We dug without secure footing while we tried to get a clean sample and keep track of our position relative to a base elevation. But in this environment, it was difficult to the point of being silly, and we cycled back and forth between riotous laughter and rageful frustration throughout those long days of cartwheeling down the hills. One time, when I dug up with the claw end of my hammer, I cracked something odd, and pounds of sparkling clear amber rained down on my head. "So this is what it's like to be an earthworm," Bill remarked once after a particularly big avalanche, and I remember pausing in appreciation of how his observations were always so spot on. At least once a day, we indulged ourselves in the following way. We'd plop down waist deep in the crunchy rubble and pull out some treats. Nothing tastes as good as a Snickers bar and a hot thermos of coffee in the cold middle of nowhere. And once a day, we focused all of our energy towards savoring this pleasure in quiet, companionable reflection. One day, after we had chewed our last bites, Bill raised his arm and silently pointed at a gray speck many yards off. I puzzled for a moment and then saw that he was pointing out an Arctic hare. Coming across an animal, any animal, is a rare treat in the Arctic, because a herbivore must travel long distances to keep itself fed upon the sparse moss and lichen available, and a carnivore must, by extension, keep moving to follow wide-roaming prey. The hare came closer, picking among the rocks, and then began to move away from us. Bill and I stood up and followed it, keeping a good distance and leaving our gear behind. We walked for about a mile without talking, following the hare and watching it, trying to exploit the visual novelty that it offered against the bleak and monotonous landscape. It was a large hare, big as a Sheltie dog, and with similar fur, long ears, and a long, lean body. It didn't seem to mind us following it at a distance of a quarter mile or so, so we hung back and followed for more than an hour. There was no real way for us to get lost. We could walk all day and still turn around and see the day-glow orange tents of our campsite. When you are supremely isolated among just a handful of people, those few people can quickly begin to seem suffocating. And they did. Except for Bill, I had discovered. Before that trip, I had never really spent 24/7 with anyone for weeks on end. And it seemed that with every passing day, it got easier for us and not harder. Regardless of whether we were awake or asleep, we were never more than a few feet apart, though always in separate tents. Some days we chattered incessantly. Some days we said only a few words. And then we lost track of what we did or didn't say, of how much we were talking or not talking. We were just us, being us. On the day that we followed the hare, we eventually found ourselves on a geographical high point, and I turned to see that our colleagues back at the dig were only fuzzy specks in the distance, as we must have been to them. In the other direction, we could see the edge of a glacier that lay like a thick white layer of frosting, still several miles away. I sat down to admire it, and Bill sat down a few feet away from me. We sat in silence for another half hour, until Bill finally said, "It feels weird not to be working." "I know what you mean," I said. "We've dug through every layer twice while sampling. It doesn't make any sense to do it again." "But we have to do something," countered Bill. "Otherwise the grizzly Adamses down there are going to wonder what the hell we're doing on this trip, won't they?" I laughed. "They already wonder what I'm doing here, and digging to China and back wouldn't convince them that I'm a legitimate scientist." "Really?" Bill looked at me in surprise. "I always figured it was just me who felt like a random mistake." "Nah," I assured him. "Look at those guys. I'm going to do this job for 30 more years, work as hard as any of them, accomplish just as much or more, and not one of them will ever look me straight in the eye like I belong here." "Well, at least you have two whole hands," Bill countered, wiggling his incomplete set of digits. "That's a good start, anyway." I lay back and looked at the sky. "Oh, come on, nobody ever notices your hand," I said. "Honestly, you're more normal-looking than anyone I know. I don't know why you don't get that."
"Are you sure?"
"Why don't you poll some little kids about it?" Bill asked. "Like my second-grade class, my third grade, and high school, and so on." I sat up with a start.
"They teased you? At school? About your hand?"
The idea enraged me.
"Yep,"
Bill confirmed quietly, still staring at the sky. I pushed the point. "So, is that your deal? You've carried that all these years? Is that it, living in a hole, no friends?"
"That's about right," Bill confirmed.
"You never did Cub Scouts, joined a team, all that crap?"
I listed all the usual milestones that I had taken for granted.
"Now you're getting it," Bill acknowledged.
"You've never been on a date, have you?" I asked. It seemed to have been hanging in the air, and it just felt right to say it. Bill stood up and raised both arms into the endless blue-white sky that seemed, on that bright July day, to be incapable of darkness.
"I never went to the prom!"
he howled. When our laughter died down, I thought a little and then spoke.
"So why not now?" I suggested.
"We're in the middle of nowhere. With no one to see you, you could dance now." There was a long pause.
"I don't know how," said Bill.
"Yes, you do," I insisted. "It's not too late, come on. We came all this way. Jesus, this is why we're here. I just figured it out. This is the place where you dance." To my surprise, Bill didn't joke it off this time. He took a few steps toward the glacier. He stood and stared at it for a long time with his back to me. Then he slowly began to turn in a circle and stomp, and do rough jumping skips in between stomps. It started out awkward.